Welcome to Industry Misinterpretations episode 98 with James Robertson and Michael Lucas Smith. This week we discuss Smalltalk code organization across bundles, packages, namespace, parcels, and class categories, and we also discuss C-side scaling a little bit. Along the way we discussed a few other topics that came up, including a long thread in VWNC about various aspects of the CINCOM Smalltalk development environment. If you have feedback, please send it to smalltalkpodcasts@cincom.com or head on over to the Industry Misinterpretations group on Facebook. You can also join us in the Smalltalkers group at Ning, and please head on over to Podcast Alley and cast a vote for the podcast. So we got a couple of listener emails this time.
Yep.
So I guess we wanted to start with the first one on... Well, the first one's interesting. It's about a bunch of questions about namespaces, packages, and all that stuff. I guess I could just read the email. Guy says, I'm fairly new to both Smalltalk and VisualWorks, and one of the most confusing aspects for me is when I should use namespaces, packages, bundles, class categories, and parcels. And this isn't the first time we've heard this complaint. It's a little better in the sense the categories are at least out of the browser now, but people still get confused by this because there are so many ways to slice and dice the system.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, there aren't enough ways to slice and dice the system, actually.
Well, you want to provide more confusion for people?
Yeah, I do. Actually, I want to be able to arbitrarily break up the insides of packages and group packages together in more useful ways. I think one of the problems that people come across is when they discover that when they organize things into bundles that it becomes versioned, it's a bit awkward because they don't really want to version it as a separate program. It's all one program. But yeah, we've got stuff in there like categories, right? And categories, we don't use them anymore.
Well, I think the problem is if you step back one, especially for somebody who comes to Smalltalk new from something else, I think one of the problems initially is with namespaces. It's not that they don't understand namespaces. It's that in most of the systems out there, namespaces and packages are kind of bound together.
Yep.
So they expect namespaces and packages to be bound. And then they find out that in our system, namespaces and packages are independent entities. You can have one namespace and use it across two, three, four, however many packages you want. And that seems to bother some people.
Yeah, most people don't do that. Usually we have a namespace per package. When you want to extend someone else's program, you usually pick up their namespace and just go with that. And your package, you know, by virtue of not having a certain namespace, is sort of an extension, a library.
Well, some people do it this way and some people don't. I mean, I think the bind a namespace to a package idea, certainly you had that idea for a while. I know Travis initiated this before he came to CINCOM as something that he really wanted to see. Internally, though, before that, there was no real even nascent standard here at CINCOM. People were putting namespaces across packages. There was nothing that resembled a standard.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at Java, the very first time they introduced namespaces, version 1 of Java, they said it straight from the start. It's DNS addresses.
Right.
So yeah, I mean that's a good idea. Why didn't we do that? I don't know.
Well, I think the thing is that we kind of rolled our own namespace system and we didn't really reflect that much on what had been done. There have been multiple times I think I've heard people in the development team and on and outside the development team say that if we had it to do over again, we'd do X. And it's not that everybody agrees what X is, but I think a lot of people understand that what we have isn't necessarily the most optimal way to implement this that could have been done. So let's get back to your thing about bundles. I mean, bundles, the big problem with them is that you use them kind of as configuration management. And I know I've used them for various projects I've worked on because without using bundles, you kind of go insane. But on the other hand, if you do use bundles, you go insane because they're not really configuration management.
Yeah, they're a halfway house. It's the spork, but the edge isn't rounded and the prongs are blunt and knobbly. It's meant to be a Swiss Army knife thing where you can use it for all kinds of different things, but in the end, that just means that it's not very good at anything.
Well, let me step back and just explain what a bundle is from my perspective first. I mean, it's a tree structure that can hold an arbitrary number of other packages and or bundles, and you can nest those as infinitely deep as you want. The difficulty you get into is that you use them because you want to say, I'd like to load my entire package blah, and I want to have everything that is supposed to be part of package blah come in. So you put everything in there. The difficulty you get into is that if people version off other editions of things, then you have to manually update everything. Setting prerequisites inside the bundle is not that simple. The reason you use them, though, is that setting individual prereqs on a package for, say, a specific version of something is a royal pain in the neck. It's very difficult to do and very difficult to maintain.
Yeah, and from my perspective, one of the first uses of bundles that I came across when I moved from Visual Age Smalltalk to VisualWorks was I wanted to be able to organize my code better. I wanted to be able to break up the classes into groups of things. So you find that a lot of projects will have a bundle that then has packages in them that are purely there for humans, you know, human categorization of their information. And therefore, you usually get circular prerequisites and all that mm-hmm. kind of stuff.
Well, that's the main reason I've used them for things like bottom feeders, just to make sure that the main parts of the package are inside of it. But even I've moved away from it. There are plenty of outside prerequisites that even something like that has. And I've noticed that you and Travis, for instance, almost never use bundles at all anymore. I've seen that in most of the projects you guys do outside the scope of SynCom work, or you know that are partly related and partly not, like OpenGL and Cairo and all those things, it's just package level stuff with prerequisites.
Yeah, I do use the bundles to make a development bundle that people can more easily load when they want to try out stuff. But that's pretty much it. I'm very sparing on the features of bundles that I use. I just want to make it so that you don't get prompted 50 times for which version of stuff you want to load from store. I mean, this is another problem in store is that, yeah, there isn't any kind of configuration map. So if you wanted to group a whole bunch of versions together, you can do it by prerequisites, but then people have to know which versions to load, or you can do it by bundles, and then you have all the management issues.
Well, you know, that's the thing is, this is one of the other things that drives people crazy, I think, is just in terms of the way prerequisites are done, and in terms of the way defaults are done, it seems to me that having prerequisites auto-load would probably be a useful default, especially for non-commercial people. But you look at the way that comes in, it's all manual. So when you confront the neophyte with SynCom Smalltalk and you tell them, go load the Cairo stuff that Michael or Travis has done from the public store, they're then confronted with a blizzard of dialog boxes because the default is you pick what loads. And then they don't have any idea how to answer those questions. When if you just set it to auto, that's not always the right answer. But I think for a neophyte, it's almost always the correct answer.
And another thing that's kind of a mistake is treating configuration maps as a fork, right? The store doesn't actually include any forking ability. You just tag the versions with something else. So if you actually made a project per se, and then you fork it off and make your code and publish that, and then you can merge that back into the head, that should include all of the prerequisites that you're talking about. So that would then load as a complete unit, and you get, I mean, this is how some of the other version control systems out there work, and it works really well. You specify your entire project in the version control system. So it's like a blur between a configuration map and forking, because you can fork it at any time and completely change that configuration, and then, you know, that can become the main branch. So you usually start off with an empty project, and then you immediately branch it into, like, I don't know, version 1.0, and then off that you branch it into some piece of work you're going to do, like, you know, AR54718 or something.
Which is how in our internal version control system I see package names that have just a blizzard of meaningless, well, to me meaningless, they're meaningful to the engineers, but to me meaningless tag names after them, because people are using
those
the
tags.
Name of the package. Yeah, but they're not even tags. I mean, you call them tags, but they're pseudo tags because they're in the title of the package. They're not some additional piece of meta information.
I mean, well, one of the problems is that from a conceptual level, we require a version number on everything. When that's not really right. And you want to be able to version something off when you want to share it. And so instead of versioning each little asset inside your project with a pseudo tag on the end, you put it all inside a fork, and that fork is the thing that has the tag on it. And that way, you don't really have to name anything. And when someone wants to load a version of your program, your project, they're going to go after the name of a branch. They're not going to go after the individual versions of packages inside it. And it's pretty easy at that point. But, you know, I'm talking about stuff that doesn't exist, so there you go.
Well, going down to the next thing in the little list of complaints this guy sent in, or not really complaints, just issues, class categories, we've mostly deprecated that. The browser used to have a view to show categories, and this was the old classic way to categorize things. And the way you categorize things now is to use package names or bundle names. You can't really categorize with categories because there's no view to show that anymore. I mean, they're still there in the system. Yeah. They're still there in the system, but you can't use them.
Yeah, and you even if we did show them in the RB as part of the tree, it really wouldn't be the desired effect. As soon as you like extended string,
mm-hmm.
Now you've got a category of system collections string in your view, which isn't really what you want. You probably want to throw them into your own extensions category and set forget. So like, you can set categories on the class definition, but you can't set them on extensions.
Right. So generally speaking, I think you just want to avoid class categories, at least in VisualWorks and Object Studio, because they don't really have a purpose anymore.
That's right. And that's what I'm saying. I want more options. I want to replace categories with something that can actually, you know, tag these extensions and classes into their own groups. And ironically, we call them tags. But there's no implementation actually included in VisualWorks yet. Travis has been pulled off UI stuff to primarily work on builds. So, you know, that work is kind of on hold.
And he enjoys that so much.
Oh, yeah, he loves it, yeah.
So that gets us to the last thing on this list is parcels. And parcels are kind of a neither fish nor fowl thing from the display standpoint. I'd say that the question this guy asked as to whether or not they're mostly a runtime artifact is yes. You mostly want to use parcels for deployment. But the reason that it's confusing is that if you go to the browser, there is a parcel view. And the reason there's a parcel view is that every time I've asked this
that's
question...
That's gone now, I think. I think that's gone in 7.7.
Okay, in 7.7. Okay, but in 7.6, it's still there. And the reason it's there, every time I asked about it, was, well, there are some things you can do with parcels that you can't do with packages. And there was never anything that I particularly missed. I suppose there are things that people use, but it is confusing for neophytes, again, to see these various views when parcels are primarily a deployment mechanism.
Yeah, but, you know, even parcels are going to sort of take a back step to Smalltalk archives at some point.
You would hope so. You would hope so. You should tell people what Smalltalk archives are, because unless they're using Object Studio 8, they have no idea.
Well, you know, you had this kind of cryptic pause there, and you were making a funny gesture with your hands. So, you know, James likes to make funny gestures with his hands.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got the special video button in iTunes, you'll be able to see them. But you know, if you don't have the special button, you won't be able to see them. Smalltalk archives. If you've ever used Monticello in Squeak, you get the MCZ. This is the American version. MCZ file. You know, it rhymes. And it's like a zip file that includes a bunch of stuff. Source code, binary, version history and stuff. Smalltalk Archives is sort of similar for VisualWorks, where we take the parcel file and source file and any other artifacts that you need to run your program and stick them in a .star file, S-T-A-R, Smalltalk Archives. So that way you've got one file that you can it's portable, you can move it around, you can drop it into your deployment server. We kind of do the same in WebVelocity, except we give you two files, obviously the parcel binary and the parcel source. But, you know, it's still drop and forget sort of stuff. But the star means that you've only got one file zipped up and you can share it around more easily.
So getting back to parcels, the way parcels work is they're, you know, the split binary and source thing. And they are mostly a deployment mechanism. I have used them back before store existed for version control, and I would strongly advise anybody who's thinking they don't want to use store not to do that, because if there's one thing you can do very easily with parcels, it's lose source code if you're using them this way.
Yeah, you have to be careful as to whether you're saving the source code into your own changes file or into its changes file.
The PST, yeah.
All right. I mean, that's interesting. And you can also publish parcels without source code, so that it won't have any links into the PST file at all. So you won't get a PST file. But I found in my previous life before Syncom that PCL files, the parcel files, are not binary identical every time you make them. They include timestamps as well. So from the technical point of view of people who are interested in that sort of stuff, it's not really a full compilation unit sort of thing. It's an artifact of producing something from your source code. So, you know, if you compile with GCC, your C program, and you do it with various switches, you can get a binary identical file every time, and you can create an identical MD5 sum. You can't do that easily with parcels. But, you know, most people don't care.
No, most small talkers don't care. I suspect that this might be part of the concern of a conversation we had a good long while ago, where the GCC people were, I think it was the Ubuntu people or Debian people were a little worried about what kinds of artifacts the Squeak people were producing as far as including Squeak on their distro. And that kind of thing is one of the things that bothered them, that they couldn't see where everything came from, because in their world, like you said, you can produce these binary identical things just on demand, whereas in Smalltalk, that's not usually anything that can be done, and most Smalltalkers don't even think about it.
Yep.
So, I guess to summarize, namespaces, you probably, as a best practice, I think we both say you probably want to have namespace per package. Bundles, you typically use them to organize code to make it easier to load things, but they have issues. Overrides and bundles are still problematic, even though they're sort of kind of supported. Setting prerequisites and all of that is kind of a pain in the neck with them. Class categories, just avoid them completely, and parcels, worry about them only from a deployment standpoint.
Yeah. That doesn't actually make anything simpler, but there you go.
Yeah. There's our answer for all of you that asked that question. Did you want to go to the seaside conversation, or did you want to leave that for another day?
Well, we got time, don't we?
Yeah, we have time.
Yeah.
So we had another question. He wanted to ask a question about Seaside and scalability, because he was coming into Seaside as basically a neophyte on that and wasn't sure what the scalability story was or wasn't. So since Michael's been working on Web Velocity, and Michael knows a lot more about this, I think, than I do, I guess one of the things that people worry about is with sessions and continuations, they worry that memory consumption is just going to be too enormous. Now, a lot of that was addressed in 2.8, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't use that much memory anymore. I gave a presentation of Web Velocity to some management types recently, and sitting amongst the management types was someone who was actually technically minded, and he had the same sorts of questions about scaling. From a practical point of view, we hide the web container in Web Velocity. And, you know, this is for people who understand Java terminology. So the web container is hidden. And that causes some problems when we try to explain how this stuff works to people sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Because they expect to see, you know, settings for twiddling, how much memory it uses, how the garbage collector works, high and low level watermarks for connections and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
All that stuff is there. We just hide it because the defaults seem to work pretty well for most people. And when it doesn't work for you, then we can tell you how to change it. So anyway, I'm going to make a video showing how an application built with Web Velocity scales. Excuse me, I got hiccups now. And I'm going to do it with HTTPerf. I'm just going to create a simple application, then just smash it with 1,000-odd connections a second or something like that and see what kind of results we get. If it's bad, I don't mind. I'll still put the video out. I want to be honest about this stuff, and then we'll put it in our to-do list to fix that. But I'm not expecting it to be bad. We've built all this stuff on the top of, you know, tried and proven technology that's in production in big systems. So, yeah, we have all the high low watermark stuff there. By default, we just let it grow till it doesn't need to do it anymore. But usually the performance problems that you get in Seaside, well, just web applications in general, is to do with the database.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we have built into Web Velocity by default connection pooling. So that's just the, you know, on by default. And that will make connections to the database whenever it needs them and free them once it's done its thing. And that pretty much solves 90% of performance issues in Seaside.
Yeah. Now, just to bring this up for people who don't know about, you know, who are maybe somewhat familiar with 2.6 and 2.7, and remembered that the older versions had issues with lots of memory consumption. You might want to watch the. There was an interview that Abby Bryant gave at a conference he was at last March. I don't know if you've seen it, and he's talked specifically about that. That in the when they moved Apple DB from 2.6 to 2.8, they noticed a fairly large drop in resource consumption. You know, in that interview that Abby did, he mentioned that when they went from 2.6 to 2.8, they did see an improvement in memory consumption. But it should be pointed out that they were on 2.6 for a good long time and launched a commercial and successful project on 2.6. And moreover, from a scaling standpoint, they were using Squeak, not Syncom Smalltalk. And I've done a little bit of benchmarking between the two, and VisualWorks scales a whole lot better than Squeak does. And if Squeak is good enough to put a commercial project on, certainly VisualWorks is.
Oh, yeah. I think, you know, we've kind of been brainwashed into worrying about performance so much. And it's easy to forget that you should just try it and see what happens. But at the same time, as a programmer sitting out there thinking about using WebVelocity or Seaside, it's a fair question to wonder, if I put the effort and time into doing this, will I have to throw it all away at the end because it doesn't scale? So, yeah, we need to make some videos on that to show you that you're not going to be wasting your time and reassure you of that. But, you know, from a podcast point of view, with no ramifications about what I say at all, yeah, you're not going to have a problem with that.
Well, it's interesting what expectations are. I was having a talk with somebody about using Seaside and WebVelocity for a potential project that we're looking at. And he was going through all of the standard things that you'd include in a Java environment if you wanted to worry about scaling. You know, they talked about the web container you mentioned before, all those settings. They talked about having the ability to use, you know, WebSphere for a front-end thing where you'd immediately get the failover and multiple VMs out there and all that stuff. And then we finally went through like 15 minutes of that. And then we asked him, so how big a system were we talking about? And he said, well, probably no more than 500 concurrent users. And there were three of us in the room, and we all kind of looked at each other. And finally, one of us said to him, well, you know, probably one Smalltalk image on a middling Linux box would handle that.
Yeah.
So, you know, the scaling concerns people have, it's not that they're not real. It's that I think people are assuming that they're going to need more than they really do. It's not that those things, it's not the failover and all of those things are not important. It's just that people have an overblown sense of what's needed, at least initially. So you just have to scale your expectations, too. Most people are not writing the next version of Twitter.
Yeah, well, neither were the Twitter guys.
Yeah, well, there is that. So actually, I think that's something to look forward to, though, is those scaling videos you're talking about. I'll promote those because certainly people will be interested in those, and they'll answer a lot of good questions.
Huge mail, email, blah, huge mailing list thread on VWNC about, what, this mailing list is so big I've forgotten the title of it.
Oh, this was the thing that Arden kicked. Arden kicked this off. He asked a question about whether people would be interested in using an external editor for creating Smalltalk code.
Well, that's not really what he asked, was it?
That was one of the things. That was one of the things he asked. That was one of the things people focused in on.
Oh, my God. How many pages of emails is there? It's just scrolling forever.
It's a long one.
It's huge. So there was a question, you know, a quote from a guy called David Mertz. I'm very ambivalent about the imposed GUI development environment interpreted that Smalltalk squeaks specifically in this tutorial imposes on you. Now, just to cut in there, Squeak imposes all kinds of things on you because it's evil.
and you can send all your hate mail to Michael. Now that he's in the U.S., you can even find him. He's no longer in the future, so you can catch up with him now.
That's right. I'm in phase with you guys, but... Yeah, so beyond that, okay, Smalltalk code focuses on ultra-short methods that really require the Smalltalk environment to browse and develop. I still feel a purity in separating my text editor from anything else about the underlying language mechanisms. Smalltalk Squeak is as far... Okay, can I do the radio voice? Smalltalk Squeak is as far from... I can't do it. Far from that as is possible to get. Think Eclipse on steroids and without any close button. What does he mean by no close button?
I'm not even sure what that means.
Anyway, so the questions were kicked off on the mailing list. If we made it so that you could write Smalltalk code in your favorite editor, what would that be a bridge to help you become acquainted with Smalltalk? And second, would the comfort it brings overcome losing the power that the integration currently gives you?
Well, so, you know, I used to think that this was a good idea. Up until a few months ago, I really was in favor of this idea. And I think the more I've thought about it, the less enamored of it I've become. Because I've decided that, you know, there are other things, and part of it's in this thread, there are other things that make people step back from the environment once they're exposed to it. And I don't think this is really one of them. It's one of the things people do have to get over, but I think there are other impediments, you know, just there are things in the environment that could be improved that would help people an awful lot more than worrying about this.
Yeah, like the text editor.
Yeah.
Right?
Well,
I mean, you spend all of your time in the text editor writing methods and stuff, but it doesn't work very well. If anyone wants to reboot back to the first Macintosh and, you know, trying to use that to author documents, and that's sort of like the level of editing. I mean, no one's really paid any attention to it for years. And interestingly enough, it's the same deal in Squeak. There's a project going on right now. A guy's making a new source code editor in Squeak, specifically focused on having the editor work like any other editor you'd use outside of Smalltalk, so that it's normal and standard. And okay, so that thread was pretty big. Ironically, the question is to people who aren't small talkers who are lurking on the list, but the majority of the thread comes from people who are small talkers,
right,
who have an opinion on why they think people aren't using small talk, even though they're using small talk, which is in many respects kind of ironic. Along those lines, Anthony Blakey started a new thread, and his is, any interest in a server-focused reboot of VW? This sort of carries on from the last two podcasts we did, where he argued that he didn't need to set up a website. He's since decided to set up a website, and he's poking and prodding the mailing list to see who'd be interested in joining him in a major rewrite of very, very large sections of the entire system.
Well, you know, it's interesting you talk about a server thing, because interestingly enough, while deploying a client Smalltalk system, like, you know, and I have some experience with this with Bottom Feeder, is not the easiest thing in the known universe. Deploying a server is actually pretty darn simple now. You know, you use a command line flag to make it start up without a GUI. You use other command line flags to tell it what to load at startup. And you can control the startup with configuration files that you just edit with an arbitrary text editor. So ironically, setting up a server-based Smalltalk system is actually pretty easy now, whereas it didn't always used to be easy.
Yeah, all the command line stuff, that's really made it pretty simple. I don't think I've deployed a Smalltalk server in the last few years that isn't just started up from a bash script.
Well, that's how mine are. I have a bash script that starts it up. I have configuration files, both Smalltalk script and non-Smalltalk script, to configure things. And, you know, with one of the servers we have, Pete set it up to run as a cron job, so the cron will automatically start it or restart it if it's not running. So this is not hard to do now. It used to be hard to do. When I started running the Smalltalk wiki back in VisualWorks 7.0, actually, no, I think I started it in 5i.4, it was not at all simple to deploy a server, because you needed all kinds of funky arguments to get things to run without the GUI. You needed to save it specifically in a headless mode. There were a bunch of things you had to do to get it to run right, and those are all gone now. So specifically, server-side stuff is easy in Smalltalk now.
Well, web velocity is even easier. You just drop your code into the autoload directory, and that's it. You just run it.
Right. And, you know, but that's the point, is that this stuff on the server side...
But that's not what he's talking about. When he says the server reboot, what he's saying is that he wants to completely break all the GUI paradigms, because he wants to build server-side code and therefore doesn't care whether he's compatible with GUI stuff or not. That's what he's saying. Because he's got some ideas about how he wants things to work, and some of them are interesting and good ideas. Some of them I'm not so sure about. But I guess I'd be interested to see where he goes, and... Some of what he's talking about are things that we're intending to do in the product at some point.
Well, a goodly number of the UI things that he's on about are useful things. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily have the same look all the time. And I'm not criticizing his UI stuff. I'm just saying different people could differ about various UI things he's done. But most of the kinds of UI things he's done are things that we either plan to do or ought to do.
That's right. I mean, he's got his ASB Aqua, which looks nothing like Aqua. Started out as an Aqua thing, but it's just his own look and feel now. It's kind of interesting. And, you know, if you don't care about looking correctly native on the platform, which a lot of people don't, then loading that up is a good way to give your application a facelift.
Well, that actually came up in the thread you mentioned on BWNC, where somebody mentioned mid-thread that it was less important to look native than to have a look and feel that looked good enough to work with.
Yeah, that's the Eclipse approach right there. Eclipse is all, you know, Eclipse comes with the libraries to do native widgets and stuff, but the actual Eclipse environment is all pretty much rendered by itself. It's got some cool gradient stuff in there. It doesn't look native at all, but it lends itself to the kinds of tools that they want to build.
We should probably wrap this up.
Yep.
Besides, it's breakfast time. You can actually go downstairs and get breakfast. Your long-standing complaint.
That's right. Uh-oh.
Speaking of things you don't want to see, you didn't want to see what Michael just did. He's reattaching parts of his body now.
What did you say? I just kicked out. I was so excited about the food. I kicked the connection from my headphones.
Well, to hear what I said, you'll have to listen to the podcast. I'll ensure that part stays in. All right, go have breakfast.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
In this next segment, I have Dave Buck with this week's Cimbron Design Minute.
This is David Buck with today's Cimbron Design Minute. Software tool vendors will put out new releases from time to time, and when they do, the development teams that use those tools need to decide if and when to upgrade. Often, it's not convenient to upgrade as soon as the new release is available. The project may be too close to a release. There may be a high rate of bug fixes to make. Maybe there's a new major feature being developed that's taking the full attention of the developers. It's all right to wait a bit before upgrading your tool set, but don't make it too long a wait. The longer you wait, the harder the upgrade becomes. I've seen projects that haven't upgraded in 15 years. Then they find that upgrading becomes a multi-month project with a high risk of going over budget. Usually the only way to perform these tool upgrades is to try it and tackle the problems that come up one by one. When you wait several releases to upgrade, the number of problems you'll encounter increases and the upgrade becomes much harder. As far as possible, try to keep up to date with the tool vendor releases. This has been the Cimbron Design Minute. Cimbron offers training and consulting in object-oriented development and the Smalltalk programming language. For more information, visit www.cimbron.com or email info@cimbron.com.
In this segment, we have James Savage with the week's Smalltalk Jobs Report.
I'm James T. Savage, and this is the Smalltalk Jobs Report. Niall Ross, our British Isles contributor, reports that in Cavan, Ireland, Computer Futures Solutions is looking for a software developer who also has experience with Visual Basic, C#, and database design and management. This contract pays 38,000 euros per year. Quoting Mr. Ross, "This looks like an intended conversion with its reference to 6 months in Smalltalk, then C#, and its .NET developer heading." Sydney, Australia. Ashdown Consulting is looking for a junior engineer who has a university IT degree or tri-tier qualifications or 2 years commercial experience. Strong understanding of OO principles, interest in dynamic programming languages, basic knowledge of C, good verbal and written communication skills, and works well in a team environment. Considered a plus includes the following: knowledge of Python, Ruby, or JavaScript, experience and understanding of UI design and development, understanding of Win32 programming, and familiarity with Windows. This permanent position pays 45,000 to 55,000 Australian per year, and to quote from one of the online postings, "As a junior engineer, you will be assisting in the design process for new features in the company's Navigator team, working on their Smalltalk Windows clients and developing new features and maintaining their existing Enterprise Content Management, ECM, products." Minneapolis, Minnesota. IT Solutions, Intech, Apex Systems, and Blackstone Technology Group are looking for a software developer engineer 2 who has experience with enterprise software development using Smalltalk, Java, Unix scripting, TIBCO, MQ series, solid knowledge of packet-based networks, 3+ years of software development experience in Unix and Linux environments, and advanced Smalltalk development. Experience that is considered a plus includes XDSL and FTTX technologies, Smalltalk development for large-scale deployments and complex relationships, bachelor's degree in computer science or an equivalent degree in sciences and engineering would also be preferred. Master's in computer applications would be a plus, but not required. Candidates certified in IT industry recognized skill assessments such as MSCD, MCSE, BrainBench, etc. preferred. This 6-month contract pays $50 per hour. Secaucus, New Jersey. Artec Information Services, Calebra, and ProHire are looking for a Smalltalk developer. Experience with Gemstone is considered a plus for this 1-year contract. These are just a few examples of the Smalltalk positions that are currently open across the world. For more details, visit my blog, Message Sends with an Undefined Object. Good luck with your job hunting.
Up next is Randall Schwartz with a quick look around the Squeak world with Squeak News.
This is Randall Schwartz here with your latest Squeak News. You can find all this news and more at news.squeak.org. Macworld Magazine is running a series of reviews of their favorite free and low-cost applications for the Mac. And one of their picks is Plop, a painting tool from Impara for easily creating cartoon-like 3D scenes. Although the review doesn't mention this, did they even know it? Plop was developed and runs totally in Squeak, which of course means that it's also available on Windows and for free on Linux. Plop seems to be getting a lot of attention at the moment, perhaps because you can also use it to create models for use in Second Life. So congratulations to all at Impara for the recognition their work is getting. For Squeak Weekly News, this is Randall Schwartz. You can also check out my blog at methodsandmessages.vox.com.
If you enjoyed this week's podcast, please tell other people about it. We'd love to have more Smalltalkers and more developers learning about Smalltalk through the industry misinterpretation of the podcast. If you have feedback, send it to smalltalkpodcasts@syncom.com. Head on over to Facebook, join the Industry Misinterpretations group. Head on over to Ning and join the Smalltalkers group. Or head on over to Podcast Alley and cast a vote for the podcast. In the meantime, have fun with Smalltalk.
So special episode of Industry Misinterpretations. This time we have video.
Oh, are you recording that?
Yeah.
Oh, wonderful.
You got to press the special video button in iTunes. If you can't see the special video button in iTunes, then I guess you can't see us.
Oh, well, there you go. So I think the video will not be being released because people are not mentally prepared to see what I look like at this hour of the morning.
Yeah. But I can tell you that he does have a funny hat on. I don't know why he has a funny hat on. It's kind of a rude looking hat.
That's what little of my hair is left after having talked to you for the last couple of years.
This is the I Want My Food episode of Industry Misinterpretations.
Yeah, you can't handle the food anyway.
You can't handle the food.
Hi, I'm a bit of a latecomer to the podcast, but I've enjoyed the last 10 or so. However, I have to say the Oh, no, that's... Never mind, that's the...
No, no, come on, finish. Come on.
Okay,
no,
well, I copied the wrong part of this message.
Put the keyboard down.
Okay, so...
For those of you with the video link at this point.
Okay, so I'll finish it. However, I have to say that issue 96 really has a cheesy sound to it. You simply must tell Randall and David to ditch the radio voices. I'm not sure what to suggest. Have a beer or smoke while doing their slots. So, all right. Well, let me get back to his original question now that Michael's forced me to read that.
James, don't do that. God, it's disgusting. But he's actually standing on top of his chair right now. It's quite embarrassing. But
I think it just has to do with namespace. But you're just not being very cooperative today.
That's because you won't let me eat. Are you going to answer that? James is now taking his shirt off. I don't know why. He's got the phone in his hand and he's waving the shirt around. It's kind of weird. I'm not sure he realizes there's a mirror. I can see both sides of him. Oh, he's back.
Well, that'll be compelling audio to be snipped out.
No, don't snip it out. There's exciting stuff there. And if you have the special video button in iTunes, then you'll be able to see what James was just doing, and it's kind of funny. I won't tell you which part of his body he reveals, but it's kind of funny.
You have no idea how much editing I have to do on this podcast.
I just keep it all in. Why bother? If I keep doing it, something's sure to slip through. It's this part of the iTunes video button that some people will be able to use that I have to admit there is no special iTunes video button. I've just been saying that, but we've been recording with video on, and James has been making obscene gestures the entire time.
Well, actually, I have a recorder for Skype. If I had thought to turn it on, I could have recorded the video.
And then there would have been proof that I'm just not making this up. He's vile, people. Vile. You know, he sits there and he's got his gentle voice going. Meanwhile, fingers are flashing everywhere. It's like physical Tourette's, but the voice is fine.
Just to go back to being marginally on topic,